welcome again to Under the Olive Tree. This is the Montreal Palestinian Community radio program that comes to you live and direct from 90.3 FM on your radio dial in the city, www.ckut.ca, wherever you may be listening to us around the world on the wide web. My name is Tarek Chiroburkhan. Laith Marouf is on assignment. The Palestinian program this afternoon is going to be very, very informative. We have lots of information to come for you this week. We are going to, of course, have our weekly updates today in Palestine and this week in Palestine from our friends at the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. We are also going to be previewing a new movie that is going to come out next Friday, January 29th, a film about activist Rachel Corrie. There actually right now is a press screening at Cinéma du Parc, and we are going to be talking with some of the people involved in just a few minutes from now. For those of you who are not familiar with Rachel Corrie, Rachel Corrie was a 23-year-old American activist who was unfortunately crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer in the Rafah refugee camp about a month before the subjects that she was trying to help were moved on by the Israeli state and the Israeli army, the Israeli offensive forces, if you will. So the interesting question about Rachel Corrie is that is this the way that the state of Israel is going to treat Americans as they come? We can think of Rachel Corrie. We can think of Tristan Anderson, who is another American from the West Coast who was treated by the Israelis in the same way. He was actually shot in the head at close range. And now news comes that Israel has just deported an American journalist. So there is lots of interesting information to come about what is going on and how Israel treats people in general, not just the Palestinian people, but American people as well, as we've seen from the way the activists who have been trying to gain entry into Gaza to provide refugee assistance to the Gazans who desperately need refugee assistance. We see the way the state of Israel, the apartheid state of Israel, is treating international activists as well, whether they be activists bringing aid from England, whether they be bringing it from North America, whether they be bringing it from the Middle East. Israel seems to be quite consistent in one thing. The way it treats other people who are not Israeli is absolutely degrading, and in some cases it is lethal, as was the case with Rachel Corrie, age 23, when she was run over by an Israeli army tractor. There is this new movie that is coming out. It is made by an Israeli filmmaker. We will be getting a little bit more information about that in just one moment from now. We'll be speaking with Daniel Sekely, who is at Cinéma du Parc right now as the press screening is underway. And we will start today's program with Today in Palestine from our friends at the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, January the 20th, 2010. One fighter killed in the Gaza Strip, and families in Jerusalem received demolition orders. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources reported Wednesday that a fighter of the Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, died of wounds sustained last week in northern Gaza. The fighter was identified as Ghassan Salim Al-Tarabin, 21 years old, from Bet Hanun in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. He was wounded in an explosion that took place on January 12th and was hospitalized at the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza. The same day, the brigade stated that one of its fighters was killed and three others were wounded in a mission in Bet Hanun. Elsewhere, the Israeli municipality of Jerusalem handed out demolition orders on Wednesday to five Palestinian families living in the Al-Bustan neighbourhood. The orders said that the five families have constructed the homes they live in illegally because they did not obtain the permission of the municipality. Israel has occupied the city of Jerusalem since 1967. Since then, it has rarely given the Palestinian residents permission to build homes or renovate old ones. In the meantime, the government continues to build Israeli settlements in and around the city, an act illegal under international law. Al-Bustan is a Palestinian neighbourhood of some 88 homes, located near Jerusalem's old city. All those homes are deemed illegal by the Israeli authorities. An Israeli settlers group claimed that the land that the Al-Bustan neighbourhood was built on used to be owned by Jews prior to the creation of Israel. Al-Bustan neighbourhood was created by Palestinian families who became refugees during the War of 1948. The Jordanian government that controlled Jerusalem at the time gave them the land to live on. Elsewhere, two Palestinian civilians were kidnapped on Wednesday by Israeli troops during an invasion targeting the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Local sources said that troops stormed parts of the city and searched homes before they took the two men away. The army said that the two were taken to a military detention camp for questioning. The military accused the two men of being on what the army calls its wanted list. Since Monday, Israeli troops have kidnapped 27 Palestinian civilians during pre-dawn invasions targeting West Bank communities under the same claims. In other news, the Ministry of Interiors has made the decision to stop issuing work permits for internationals that work for non-governmental organisations in the West Bank, leaving many workers in the position where their only option to remain with their organisations is to take a tourist visa and continue to work illegally. The tourist visa is valid for a maximum of 3 months and often issued for much less time, meaning that any international working for an NGO would have to leave and then re-enter Israel under the auspices of tourism, putting them at risk of denial of entry or deportation if they manage to pass through immigration services and continue their work. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Reuben O'Shea.
Welcome back to Under the Olive Tree. My name is Tariq Jarrell-Burkhan. Laith Maarouf is on assignment. Unfortunately, he is not with us now, but he will be back with us very soon. That was the Today in Palestine report from our friends at the International Middle East Media Center, imemc.org, on the internet. We will be hearing This Week in Palestine a little bit later on in the program. Right now, we are fortunate enough to be joined by Daniel Sekele.
Hi, Tariq.
How are you doing this morning, Daniel?
Very well, thank you. You?
Okay, I'm doing okay, actually. What we have to talk about is this new film by Israeli filmmaker Simon Biton about the American activist Rachel Corrie. Rachel Corrie was 23 years old. She was a pacifist who had come to the illegally occupied territories in 2003 to give her solidarity and support to the Palestinian people. And while she was there, she was... To call a spade, she was run over, crushed to death by an Israeli army bulldozer in Gaza in 2003.
That's correct. And this film is the investigation of those events, the investigation that was never really done by the Israeli authorities. And what makes it so timely is that Simon Biton, who is an Israeli-French citizen of Jewish-Moroccan background, has really produced the equivalent of a police investigation. All the possible witnesses involved that she could reach are interviewed. And the truth of what happened emerges very clearly from their testimony. And it is, as you say, Rachel was run over and killed by an Israeli bulldozer trying to prevent the demolition of Palestinian houses.
Now, the significance of this documentary being conducted like a police investigation is the fact that the state of Israel itself never did such an investigation into the death of Rachel Corrie. All eyewitness accounts are similarly consistent that it was the army officer who simply knowingly ran over Rachel Corrie with the bulldozer. And as a result, the state of Israel has been very, very keen to sweep this whole thing under the rug, and as a result, they never did a police investigation themselves.
Well, let me be clear.
Okay.
One of the witnesses in the film is the head of the military police who conducted the investigation for the Israeli army. And his testimony is telling, because he admits quite openly in the film that when he got to the site of the crime, there was no body, there were no tanks or vehicles left, the site was completely contaminated. He never interviewed any of the Palestinian eyewitnesses to the event. He interviewed, he claims, a few of the ISM, International Solidarity Movement observers, who had witnessed it, and he admits himself that his investigation was essentially futile and based strictly on interrogation of soldiers involved, and he's quite candid about the high probability, as he puts it, that people are covering for each other here. The chief Israeli army spokesperson is interviewed by Simon Biton and gives their version of events. And it is the Israeli version of events is simply not credible, especially in view of the admissions of the military investigator.
Now, there is a memorial website that has been set up for Rachel Corey on the Internet. If any of the listeners out there want to access this page, it is www.rachelcorey.org. Rachel Corey, Corey is spelled C-O-R-R-I-E, and it is one word, www.rachelcorey.org. There was a play several years ago entitled My Name is Rachel that also dealt with this issue. This is significant because this is sort of a view from an Israeli eye
on, that's true,
onto the investigation, or the lack of investigation.
The play was very moving, and it was based on Rachel's emails and diary entries. This gives a much broader scope. There is actually even military footage of the incident, although there are frames missing at the point where Rachel is killed, tellingly. It's an enormously powerful film. I strongly recommend that people go out and see it, and I'd just like to mention that it is opening officially next Friday, the 29th of January, in English at the AMC Forum, and the French version at Cinéma du Parc. And if any of your listeners have any doubts about the gross imbalance of power in the Middle East and the true oppression that's going on, they should come out and see this movie and see what happens even to Western observers who attempt to prevent the destruction of Palestinian homes. And what the film makes very clear is that there are Palestinian civilians being killed like this all the time, about whom, unfortunately, films are not made, and about whom the Western media have no interest.
Well, so let's talk about that right now, and we do want to remind everyone that the film is opening on the 29th of January, AMC in English, at the Cinéma du Parc in French. But let's talk about that point you just raised right now. We have the example of Rachel Corey. There's this film made about Rachel Corey, the American peace activist, 23 years old, run over by the Israeli army bulldozer. We have the story of Tristan Anderson, another American activist who was shot at close range in the head, brain damage by Israeli sharpshooters, if you want to call them that. What is the why are the folk? Why is the focus on these people so important? Is it because that Western audiences are more likely to feel outrage over the Israeli murder of a Western citizen as opposed to a Palestinian citizen?
I think you're absolutely right. Stalin once said that one person's death is a tragedy and a million deaths are a statistic. And in this case, it's one Westerner's death is a tragedy, and it is. But unfortunately, hundreds of Palestinian deaths are mere statistics to the Western media in general. And there have been a series of people, including UN commanders, peace observers, etc., who have been killed by the Israeli military. Shortly, I think, around the time that Rachel Corey died, there was another peace activist called Tom Herendel who was killed. Israel is very, very concerned about not allowing Westerners into the zones where they are demolishing hundreds of homes in Gaza. They do not want Western observers seeing the brutality and the illegality of the occupation, and frightening observers away by a few close calls, or in this case, by a killing, is a very good way of limiting the amount of outside observation. I would also say that, for example, during the Gaza War, Israel completely shut off the Gaza Strip to Western journalists in order to attempt to control the media flow on it and not have people see the complete obscenity of the assault on Gaza that killed 1,400 people, most of them civilians.
And this is an ongoing crime against humanity because we can think about ever since the Gaza War, the Israeli occupying forces have continued to prevent Western media from accessing the Gaza Strip, even in the relief effort.
That's right.
And we can even think of the George Galloway Viva Palestina. We can think of the all the international activists who have made their cause and who have actually accumulated refugee supplies to provide into Gaza and who have been not allowed in by the apartheid state of Israel.
There was a very telling question at a press screening of this film, Rachel, earlier this week. One of the journalists put up their hand and said, well, tell me, how long do you think it would take to rebuild Haiti if you were going at the speed that Gaza is being rebuilt? And the answer that was given was probably something like 500 years, because as most of your listeners will know, Israel is not allowing construction supplies into Gaza. It's also restricting the flow of critical aid, food, medicine, etc. into Gaza. This is a complete crime. And, of course, Israel was totally responsible for the destruction of Gaza just a year ago. So we see that what this movie does is, I think, give the viewer an understanding of the ongoing oppression and criminality of the occupation of the Palestinian territories. These are actions carried out in a consistent spirit of indifference to human life and international law. There's a group called PACT, I believe, which is a Public Action Committee Against Torture in Israel, PACTI. And their observation is that the Israeli army has moved from disinterest in the suffering they cause to actually actively integrating that suffering into their military doctrine as a way to enforce Israeli domination of the occupied territories.
So in effect, they have not only have they come to terms with their own crimes, but they've actually started to invoke a system that works their own crimes to their advantage, which
this is right,
and which is something that we have to show that is wrong.
I think this is why movies like Rachel are so important. They show clearly. There's no sleight of hand here. There's no ideological posturing. The Israeli military, ordinary Israeli soldiers, get a chance to speak openly. And their own words reveal the truth about the indifference to human life. There's a young soldier, 25 years old, who's interviewed, who admits candidly to with complete indifference to shooting people he knows, many of whom were civilians. He seems to have no concern about that. Destruction of property, terrorization of the population, and all of this being done practically in the spirit of a joke while on tour of duty in Gaza.
We are speaking with Daniel Sekely, who is right now at Cinema du Parc, where there is a media screening of the film Rachel. Rachel is a film by Simon Bitton, who is a French-Israeli filmmaker living in Paris. Rachel is structured like a police investigation. It presents the testimony of witnesses from all sides: Palestinians, Rachel's colleagues who witnessed her death, Israeli army officials and spokespersons, tank drivers, Palestinians, and Israeli doctors who were involved in the case, and Rachel's parents. What we have been saying since 2003 is that the treatment of the Palestinians, if it is not by the apartheid state of Israel, if it is not recognized as the by the world as being the crime that it is going to be extended by the apartheid state of Israel to other people such as Rachel Corrie, other people such as Tristan Anderson. Is this a point that that is made across in this film?
The level of intimidation comes through very clearly. There's footage of activists being threatened with bulldozers, hit with tear gas, the bulldozer blades coming literally right up to where they're standing. It's clear that the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, and peace observers going in there threaten Israel's ability to work and to carry on its destruction with impunity. And so there's an attempt to drive these people out, and this is why there have been deaths such as that of Rachel Corrie here. One of the things that comes out in the movie, you keep seeing these scenes of almost lunar devastation. And one of the Israeli soldiers who served on the Rafah border area says that when he first got there, there were houses right up to the wall that Israel was building along the border, a 14-meter-high wall. By the time he left, he said all the houses had been destroyed back about 800 meters from the border. Hundreds of houses were destroyed with an average of about 10 people per house. And one of the things that comes through from one of Rachel's diary entries is that over 60% of the population in Gaza is already already refugees, some of them twice and three times from past ethnic cleansings. So this is an area that's been submitted to consistent brutality, and it continues now. One of the ways to stop it, there has to be pressure from below. It's clear that the more that people see this, the more they will become convinced of the injustice of what Israel is doing and begin to call for the movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. So I strongly encourage any of your listeners who have doubts about the injustice of what Israel is doing, go see this film. You'll be convinced that Israel needs to be forced to end its occupation. Mm. If you know anybody who has doubts, take them to see this film.
Okay, the film opens on the 29th of January. That is next Friday.
That's right.
At the AMC Forum in English and at Cinéma du Parc in French. You are live right now at the Cinéma du Parc for the press screening. Daniel, let me ask you, a good turnout? Was there a good discussion? There will be a question and answer period following the film screening.
Actually, I've got to get back downstairs in just a few moments for that, so I won't be able to stay on much longer.
Okay.
The film is running now as we speak. I just ducked out briefly in order to be able to have this time with you.
Let me ask you one final question while we have you on the line right now. One of the goals of the state of Israel's apartheid actions is to actually scare activists from joining into solidarity with the Palestinian cause. And as far as the state of Israel is concerned, they see actions like this, like the murder of Rachel Corrie, crushed to death by the Israeli army bulldozer, as positive examples of what will happen to other activists should they choose to join in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Is this something that we should be aware of? Is this something that should make us afraid of joining solidarity with the Palestinian people? Or is this the reason why we should join in solidarity with the Palestinian people?
Well, especially for those of us over here, who are not facing the kind of intimidation and danger that activists on the front line have, we should certainly be committed to demanding change, putting pressure on our government, supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel until the occupation and the oppression of the Palestinian people ends. In the film, there are a number of Rachel's teachers interviewed. And one of them says, you know, I told Rachel, Gaza's a pretty tough place. Why don't you consider going to the West Bank? And she said that Rachel Corrie responded that That was the reason she felt she had to go to Gaza. Rachel paid a terribly heavy price for her ideals, for her activism. Those of us over here can at least, certainly, put pressure, denounce strongly what's going on by the Israeli government, demand change from our government, support boycott, get involved, inform other people. All of those will help gradually turn the tide. And for those brave people who join the international solidarity movement and actually confront Israeli oppression face-to-face the way that Rachel did, you need to have enormous respect because they're taking huge risks for an exceptionally important cause. Mm.
So I think what one message that we would like to get out to potential activists who are thinking right now about affecting solidarity with the Palestinian people is please do not fall victim to the intentions of the apartheid state of Israel. Please do not allow these instances to dissuade you or to make you afraid of standing up for the Palestinian cause. In fact, flip that around and use instances like this as the stimulus for why you should join in solidarity with the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this, Tariq. And one last time, I'd like to encourage all your listeners to come out to see this movie. It is an extraordinary document. Naomi Klein praised it as being a triumph of investigative journalism. Howard Zinn called this a moving and a totally honest film. See it. Tell your friends about it. Let's make sure that the maximum number of people finally see the truth about the real face of Israeli occupation in this film about the death of Rachel Corrie.
Okay. Daniel Sekely talking to us live from a press screening at Cinéma du Parc that is going on right now. The name of the film is Rachel by Israeli-French filmmaker Simon Bitton. It opens on the 29th of January in English at AMC Forum and in French at Cinéma du Parc. Daniel Sekely, thank you very much for joining
us. Thanks. Speak to you soon. Take care. Bye.
بغيبتك نزل الشتي قومي طلعي عالباب بغيبتك نزل الشتي قومي طلعي عالباب في فوق سجادة الصلاة واللي عم بيصلوا قلاب صوت مثل مصر المرا هو بعلبك رجال عكتر ما طلع العشب بيناتنا بيرعى الغزال بغيبتك نزل الشتي قومي طلعي عالباب في فوق سجادة الصلاة واللي عم بيصلوا قلاب صوت مثل مصر المرا هو بعلبك رجال عكتر ما طلع العشب بيناتنا بيرعى الغزال
Welcome back to Under the Olive Tree. You're listening to 90.3 FM CKUT. 90.3 on your radio FM dial here in the city of Montreal, www.ckut.ca, no matter where you may be listening to us on the World Wide Web. My name is Tariq Giro Burkhan. We were just speaking with Daniel Sekely about a new film that's coming to town. It will be premiering next Friday, the 29th of January, in English at the AMC Forum and in French at Cinéma du Parc. There is currently a press screening of the new film called Rachel, about American activist Rachel Corrie, who was murdered by an Israeli army bulldozer at the age of 23 as she was attempting to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people in occupied Gaza. One of the interesting points that was raised in that discussion we just had with Daniel Sakely was the fact that there had been no investigation whatsoever into the death of Rachel Corrie by the apartheid state of Israel, and one can only assume that it is primarily because they know that they are entirely culpable and they are entirely guilty of her out-and-out murder, which is precisely why one would assume they have swept all the investigations under the rug. And if you want to go further on that point, that is also the reason why the state of Israel refuses to allow journalists into the occupied territories, refuses to allow open, transparent access to media coverage, refuses to allow open access to UN and independent observers. The latest example of that came simply 2 days ago, on Wednesday, Israel deported an American journalist serving as head of the English department in a Palestinian-based news agency. The name of this American journalist is Gerald Malson, and he was contracted to the Mahan News Agency. He was deported by the apartheid state of Israel after being held by authorities at Ben Gurion International Airport for 8 days. What I'd like to do now is read an open letter to Benjamin Netanyahu from the Mahan News Agency calling for the release of the journalist who has been deported, Jared Malson. This is a letter addressed to the Right Honorable Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, Jerusalem, Israel. Dear Prime Minister, we are writing on behalf of the World Association of News and Publishers. And we have in our, we are writing on behalf of the World Association of Newspapers and News Publishers and the World Editors Forum, which represent 18,000 publications, 15,000 online sites, and over 3,000 companies in more than 120 countries, to express our serious concern at the detention and proposed deportation of journalist Jared Malson. According to reports, Mr. Malson, editor-in-chief of the English-language section of the Bethlehem-based Mahan News Agency and a U.S. citizen, was returning to Israel from a trip to the Czech Republic when he was stopped by security services at the Ben-Gurion International Airport in Tel Aviv on the 12th of January. Mr. Malson was detained for quote-unquote security reasons and remains in custody pending a deportation hearing. The reasons cited for denying entry were, quote-unquote, refusing to cooperate and violating visa terms, although court documents showed that security services had compiled a dossier on his journalism criticizing the State of Israel and reports written inside the Palestinian territories. Mr. Malson's lawyer obtained an injunction preventing his planned expulsion on the 14th of January, and a hearing that was scheduled for the 17th of January was postponed. We respectfully remind you that detaining and deporting Mr. Malson for carrying out his professional duties would constitute a clear breach of his right to freedom of expression, which is guaranteed by numerous international conventions, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 19 of the Declaration states, quote, "Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes the freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of frontiers." Unquote. We respectfully call on you to ensure that Mr. Malson is immediately released and allowed to carry out his professional duties free from interference. We also urge you to take all necessary steps to ensure that in future your country fully respects international standards of free expression. We look forward to hearing from you at your earliest convenience. Yours sincerely. And the letter is signed Gavin O'Reilly, President, World Association of Newspapers and News Publishers. It is also signed by Xavier Vidal-Folch, who is President of the World Editors Forum. The WANIFRA is the global organization for the world's newspapers and news publishers, with formal representative status at the United Nations, UNESCO, and the Council of Europe. The organization represents 18,000 publications, 15,000 online sites, and over 3,000 companies in more than 120 countries. This is a letter that was written to Benjamin Netanyahu from these organizations in response to the Israeli proposed deportation of Jared Malson, who is an English-speaking U.S. citizen journalist who is working with the Palestinian Mahan News Agency within the Palestinian occupied territories. The problem that this latest incident is underscoring is the lack of transparency that the State of Israel uses with regards to the actions that it carries out its objectives with throughout the illegally occupied territories, which is based on precisely preventing journalists from accessing information, preventing journalists from accessing the Palestinian people, and preventing journalists from accessing the Palestinian perspective, which guarantees that only the Israeli perspective will come through in the media reports, which is exactly what the PR front of the Israeli occupation is designed to ensure. So we have to make sure that not only does the situation change, but for it to change, it must be made sure that the citizens of the world, especially citizens in the West, realize that the news that they are receiving through this diluted and filtered Israeli media blockade, so to speak, is not the news that they are entitled to under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which guarantees every citizen of the world the freedom to information. And Israel is denying the freedom of information to citizens of the world, including Western citizens, including Canadian citizens, and including citizens of Palestine. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are now going to listen to This Week in Palestine from our friends at the International Middle East Media Center. They are available online at www.imemc.org.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for January 9th to the 15th, 2010. Eight Palestinians, among them one child, were reported dead this week in the Gaza Strip, and Israel announced its intention to resume construction in the West Bank settlements. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with nonviolent activities in the West Bank, where the Israeli military have stepped up its campaign of targeting local organizers of the nonviolent activities. IMEMC's Ghassan Bannoura with the details.
On Friday, the villagers of Bel'in and Na'lin, Central West Bank, and Al-Ma'sara, Southern West Bank, protested the Israeli-built wall on their lands. The villagers were joined by Israeli and international supporters. At the village of Bel'in, the protesters were met with live rounds and tear gas. Six people were injured by the army fire. In Na'lin, scores suffered tear gas inhalation, while in Al-Ma'sara, protesters were attacked by soldiers' batons and rifle butts. No injuries were reported.
Have the international right to stand here and film if I want?
This week, the Israeli military stepped up its campaign of targeting the local organizers of those weekly nonviolent demonstrations. Three organizers were kidnapped this week by Israeli troops in both Bel'in and Na'lin villages. Activists in Bel'in and Na'lin say the Israeli military has entered their villages and kidnapped people nearly every day for the last 6 months.
I don't want to get violent, so step away. Step away. I told you that.
Unless you show me a warrant. currently.
I don't have to show you nothing.
Yes, you do. You have to show me.
You will be arrested.
You have to show me.
No, I don't have to show you nothing.
The Israeli military considers protest organizing illegal. According to the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee, Israeli troops have kidnapped 94 residents of Ne'lin village in connection to the protests since they started nearly 2 years ago. In Bil'in, 34 residents have been kidnapped over the past 6 months. Iyad Burnat is head of Bil'in's Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlement Construction. He says arrests will not stop the movement.
This is a new Israeli policy to stop the popular struggle because it affects the Israeli propaganda and exposes the true violent face of the Israeli army. That's why they want to stop it, by arresting the organizers of those events. But in the end, we say the struggle will continue, even if they arrest us all.
The Israeli military policy does not stop at invasions and kidnappings. Some organizers report intimidation too. Mahmoud Zawahra is from the village of Al-Ma'sara near Bethlehem, where people have organized against the wall for the past 3 years.
Before the end of this of last year, they start to phone us saying that we are not going to allow to have any demonstration in the village, and if we are going to see, we are going to arrest you, we are going to put you on the blacklist, means that they will not allow us to travel and so on.
Currently, the Israeli military is holding 8 members of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements. The army says all are suspected of incitement against the military. All are currently being held based on secret evidence that their lawyers have no access to and without any charges brought against them in the military court. For IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
Israel announced this week it would resume settlement activities in the occupied West Bank in 8 months' time. Such an expected resumption coincides with the renewed accelerated efforts by Washington to bring Israelis and Palestinians back to the negotiation table. IMEMC's Nathan Stokes has the story.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told a cabinet meeting on Sunday that settlement construction would resume after the 10-month-long pause ends. Also this week, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has granted the local municipalities of the settlements permission to continue granting permits for construction, so that construction can be renewed immediately after the end of the 10-month period, due to end at the end of September. Hagit Ofran, head of the Settlement Watch Unit at the Israeli non-governmental organization Peace Now, said this is a bad sign from the government.
What the Israelis now actually signaling to the Palestinians is that, well, we're not serious about stopping the settlements, and all this moratorium is only temporary and we are not serious. And I think that's the bad sign about it, because if you already go for the very small freeze, then do it at least with honesty and not with all those tricks to make it impossible for the Palestinians to go back to the table.
Under pressure from Washington, Israel declared a temporary halt to its settlement activities on many posts in the occupied West Bank. The move was met with dissatisfaction from the Palestinian side, which demands a complete freeze of such activities so that peace talks can restart. Meanwhile, US peace envoy to the region, George Mitchell, renewed his efforts this week, trying to convince both Palestinians and Israelis to return to the negotiating table. Mitchell warned Israel that Washington would consider cutting off financial assistance if they did not commit to peace talks based on settlement freeze. Palestinian negotiators reiterated this week their refusal to resume peace talks until Israel stops settlement construction in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Palestinians want peace talks that are based on the US-backed roadmap peace plan, which demands Israel to stop all forms of settlement activities. In other news, senior exiled Hamas leader Musa Abu Marzouk blamed Israel for the failure of a prisoner swap deal between his party and the Israeli state. Abu Marzouk expected Israel's response to Hamas's list of prisoners the party wants to see released within the would-be deal. Since 2006, Egypt has been mediating a prisoner swap between Hamas and Israel based on exchanging captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, held in Gaza, with hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. Recently, a German mediator intervened, but with no concrete progress. At the internal Palestinian level, the ruling Fatah party in the West Bank demanded that the rival Hamas party in the Gaza Strip sign an Egyptian-mediated conciliation paper. Salah al-Bardawil, a Hamas legislative member in Gaza, asserted this week that his Hamas party is willing to sign the paper, but with guarantees that would preserve what he termed the national interests for the Palestinian people, including Palestinian resistance factions' right to resist the Israeli occupation. A unity deal between Hamas and Fatah has been blocked since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip amidst factional fighting with the Fatah-allied Palestinian security forces. For IMEMC.org, this is Nathan Stokes.
Eight Palestinians, among them one child, were reported dead this week in the Gaza Strip because of the continued Israeli siege and attacks. From Gaza, IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari reports.
On Sunday, Israel's military killed five Palestinians during separate attacks targeting different areas in the Gaza Strip. The Al-Quds Brigade, the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad, reported on Sunday evening that the Israeli army assassinated three of its fighters in the central Gaza Strip. The three were killed by a missile fired by the Israeli Air Force at them in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The brigade stated that the three and other fighters were about to fire homemade shells into adjacent Israeli areas. Earlier on Sunday, two Palestinians were killed after the Israeli army bombarded an area in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Israeli tanks stationed close to northwestern area of the Gaza Strip opened fire at the two residents and shot rounds of live ammunition into the area. The two were near the evacuated former settlement of Dugit. Local sources reported that the two are day laborers. A Palestinian child was reported dead on Monday after he was unable to leave the Gaza Strip for the medical care he needed. Three-year-old Maisara Musa had a heart condition, but doctors were unable to treat him in the Gaza Strip because of the siege. Doctors said that he needed an operation to save his life, but the Israeli army did not give his family the necessary permission to take him out of the coastal region. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, with Musa's death, the number of patients who died because of the Israeli siege has now reached 368. The Israeli military started its siege on the Gaza Strip in June of 2007. Also on Monday, a young man was reported dead after he fell into a tunnel at the southern Gaza Strip borders with Egypt. Local sources identified the man as Fadi Azam, 20 years old, from Rafah City. Witnesses told local media that Azam fell inside a tunnel that he works in and died due to the injuries he sustained. On Monday night, the Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas movement, reported that one of its fighters killed in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli military conducted at least 23 military incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank. During those attacks, troops kidnapped 28 civilians, including 9 children. IMEMC's Elliot Salt has the details.
The military invasions this week were focused in the cities of Hebron and Bethlehem, southern West Bank, in addition to Nablus, northern West Bank, and the central city of Ramallah. One man was injured on Monday near Hebron City in southern West Bank. Issa al-Shawaheen sustained moderate wounds when Israeli troops opened fire on his car. The Israeli military claimed that Shawaheen tried to run them over with his car before they opened fire. Two farmers and a child were injured on Wednesday at dawn when Israeli troops attacked villagers from Safa, southern West Bank, as they protested the destruction of their land. Local sources said that military bulldozers started to uproot trees and destroy farmland that belongs to villagers on Tuesday night. As soon as the villagers knew about the military attack, they rushed to their land and tried to stop it. Witnesses said that soldiers fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at them. Two farmers sustained moderate wounds after being hit with rubber-coated steel bullets, and a 5-year-old child was taken to the hospital due to the effects of tear gas inhalation, medical sources reported. Elsewhere on Thursday, Israeli settlers destroyed 3 Palestinian-owned cars at a village in northern West Bank. Local sources announced that settlers from the illegal settlement of Shafat Gilad attacked the village of Amatin near Nablus City. The settlers' rampage ended by the morning and no one was injured, but 3 cars owned by the villagers were destroyed, witnesses reported. In related news, Palestinian farmers from Yatta village, southern West Bank, accused Israeli settlers of destroying 70 of their trees on Thursday. The farmers reported that as they arrived to their lands on Thursday morning, they found that 70 of their trees had been uprooted. The land is located near the illegal settlement of Ma'an, settlers from Ma'an attacked the villagers of Yatta regularly in an attempt to take over the land in an effort to expand the settlement. Ma'an settlement is built on land that was stolen by the settlers from the villagers of Yatta and nearby Palestinian villages. For IMEMC.org, this is Elliot Salt.
And that's just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For regular updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by George Schmel.
Welcome back to Under the Olive Tree. You're listening to 90.3 FM in the city of Montreal, www.ckut.ca. No matter where you may be listening throughout the world on the wide web. Palestinian elections have been fixed for January 2010, this according to the Tehran Times. Finally, the Palestinian elections date was set. January 2010 could be a new page in the Palestinians' lives where they could be heading to choose their unity government, hoping that this time there would be real unity among the whole Palestinian people. Palestinian factions continued reconciliation talks in Cairo after Egypt extended the work of specialized committees for a few more days. This according to Palestinian officials on Sunday. Hamas and Fatah agreed on holding presidential and legislative elections by January 2010, but remained deadlocked over the key issues of forming a unity government as well as dealings with Israel. Diplomats and analysts see the success of the Egyptian-sponsored talks as key to reuniting Palestinians after 21 months of schism between the Hamas-ruled Gaza and the occupied West Bank, where the Fatah group of President Mahmoud Abbas holds power. Fatah and Hamas differ fundamentally on how to deal with Israel. The two groups agreed on holding presidential and legislative elections by January 25th, 2010. Wasil Abu Yusuf, Secretary General of the Palestinian Liberation Front, told Egypt's state-run Middle East news agency that the elections will be held by January 25th, 2010. But participants said that differences remained between Fatah and Hamas on whether the unity cabinet that would emerge from the talks be composed of political groups or nonpartisan technocrats, as demanded by Western powers and Egypt. "It is a standstill on the issue of government," said Walid al-Awad of the Communist People's Party. The groups agreed on February 26th to form five committees to hold tackle issues such as the composition of security agencies in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. One more news item that we want to get to before the end of the show here, we have about 5 minutes left, is that the former American military chief of the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq reiterates that Israeli involvement in the U.S.-run facility where hundreds of Iraqi suspects were tortured and sexually abused by U.S. soldiers and interrogators was rampant. This shed further light on the scandal that has served as a controversy magnet for Washington ever since its emergence in 2004. The retired U.S. Army Colonel Yanis Karpinski says that Israeli agents were recruited by the U.S. military at Abu Ghraib to interrogate the prisoners suspected of attacking U.S. forces in Iraq. The report, by the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, is set to fuel more debate on the matter, as Karpinski had until recently refused to expound on the Israeli connection at Abu Ghraib, despite admitting earlier to the presence of Israeli interrogators in the U.S.-run compound. U.S. President Barack Obama has strongly opposed the release of more photos and imagery of the Abu Ghraib abuses by American soldiers, despite promises to the contrary when he was first elected. Obama later argued that releasing the scandalous photos, labeled classified by the Bush administration, would inflame, quote, the theaters of war, unquote, would also jeopardize U.S. forces and make the life of troops based in Iraq and Afghanistan more difficult. This comes as amidst the recent facts and the recent speakers, as the U.S. Army Colonel Yanis Karpinski, the former American military chief of the prison, actually are coming out now and saying that the Israeli involvement in Abu Ghraib was one of the reasons why the torture and sexual abuse by U.S. soldiers and interrogators has run as rampant as it has and had been such a problem as it was. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree. My name is Tariq Juroburkhan. We will be back in just a few moments to wrap up the show today.